Former Monsanto Corporation executive Michael Taylor is now the nation's food safety czar. His 1,200 pages of new food safety rules and regulations lead us to ask, who will be able to grow government-safe food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 913th edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Noddy who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. For whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Hey, also we have a new intern, a producer, Kelly Bear. Say hello, Kelly. Right there is the microphone.
Hello.
Okay. Well, you're not supposed to push the say hello again.
Hello, everybody.
There you go. You got it this time. That's a cough button, so. All right, folks. Let's see. The industrial production of peanuts, cantaloupe, hamburger, spinach, and other foods has resulted in large-scale contaminations that have sickened many and killed some. In keeping with their stated policy of never letting a serious crisis go to waste, politicians flew into action and in the waning hours of 2010 passed the Food Safety Modernization Act, which granted to the federal government total and absolute control over the nation's food chain. Now, former Monsanto executive Michael Taylor, who now happens to be the federal government's food safety czar, recently handed down 1,200 pages of new food safety rules and regulations. These rules are scheduled to go into effect in a few weeks. Few have read all 1,200 pages, and most seemed resigned to do what former Speaker of the House would likely tell them to do, which would be something like, well, let's just enforce all the new rules and regulations and see what we are, what they are that way. Some, however, would like to have more time so that they can actually read the rules and regulations before they are put into effect. This government effort to never let a serious crisis go to waste leads us to ask, who will be able to grow government-safe food? Here to help us pursue an answer, we have Judith McGarry. Judith McGarry, who is the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. Judith, she down there in deep in the heart of Texas, right, Judith?
Yep, right in central Texas.
Right in central Texas. Beautiful country there. Boy, you know, it's been a while since you've been on the food chain. And first of all, I'd like to, we may as well go back and say, why on earth is there such an organization as the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance?
I left my legal practice and founded FARFA because what I saw was government regulations that were being written by and for, you know, the large agribusiness companies, and that were really destructive for small-scale local food producers. And since my heart's with the small-scale local food system, I'm a farmer myself, I decided that someone needed to do something about it.
And so this is a little bit like David versus or Judith versus Monsanto, David versus Goliath, Judith versus Monsanto. So there he is, Michael Taylor, former Monsanto executive at the catbird seat at the FDA, and Judith McGarry, and Michael Taylor sends out 1,200 pages of new rules and regulations, and Judith says, wait a minute, hold the phone, I haven't even had a chance to read these things. What's going on? You know, the last time, Judith, we worked together on the food chain was way back in food chain number 699, which was in September of 2010, which was when the government was considering this Food Safety Modernization Act. Since then, of course, the act has passed, been made law. Monsanto's Michael Taylor was appointed the FDA's food safety czar and is now running the food safety show. We have 2 years of developing new rules and regulations, and they're on the table now. And you put out this press release asking for more time to read them. Why do we need more time?
we need more time because although FDA has been working on it for the last 2 years, and we being all the Davids out there,
right.
Because it's not just me, all of the Davids out there only got a look at this thing in January. So, you know, FDA has been working on this, and it's very telling. It's taken them 2 years to write these rules, and then they give us 4 months to try to review them, understand them, you know, figure out the implications for our farms, and comment, because this is supposed to be what's called the public comment period, where farmers and consumers and anyone who cares about food issues can put in comments to the FDA and say, you know, here's what's good and here's what's bad with this proposal and here's what you should be changing. And that's not a quick process when you're digging through 1,200 pages.
Well, 1,200 pages of rules and regulations would probably take me 1,200 years to read them, I think. Just because, you know, one paragraph of governmentese, and I'm toast. You know, I've studied English and Chinese literature. I'm fairly conversant with language, but, boy, that government language just dumps me every time. And so, especially, you know, when you have a rule and regulation, and then you try to imagine what the implications of those rules and regulations are for agriculture, and then what is your comment? You don't have a comment because you haven't had a chance to read everything, right?
Well, I mean, I have some initial comments. I mean, unfortunately, even a first read can point out that there are a lot of problems here. And to set the stage a little bit for people who may not remember all the way back to September 2010 when you and I last talked, we do have some protection for the very small-scale direct marketing producer.
And that was the Tester Amendment, correct?
Exactly. There was the Tester-Hagen Amendment that exempted producers who are grossing under $500,000 and sell more than half directly to consumers or local restaurants and retailers.
So if you're in poverty, this doesn't count.
Exactly. And that's, you know, I think probably your listeners understand because, you know, you understand economics so well. You know, $500,000 gross is not a big farm. No, as expensive as farming is, that's still a very, very small farm. So there's some protection for the smallest producers. But then the rest of them are subject to all of these rules and regs. And, I mean, they cover everything from telling your visitors what kind of hygiene measures they have to take, if, for instance, you run like a pick-your-own operation, to testing your water every single week, which can just add up to immense amounts of expense and paperwork. So, I mean, there are already, even on a first read of these regulations, a lot of things that really raise red flags that could hurt farmers.
Well, somebody sent me, you know, some of the penalties, and I read them and I thought, oh, you got to be kidding. Civil penalty in general, any person that commits an act that violates the food safety law may be assessed a civil penalty by the administrator, he being who? Michael Taylor. Of not more than $1 million for each such act. And furthermore, each act described and each day during which the act continues shall be considered a separate offense. So if I'm hearing this right, and I have no way of knowing whether I am or not, it sounds as though if you forget to test your water once a week and for 3 weeks, then you owe Michael Taylor $3 million.
And there's a lot of possibilities within that. So the fines aren't automatically $1 million per day.
Okay.
It would be up to a lot of discretion. The agency would propose a fine. It would have to be approved by an administrative judge.
But it does raise. Yeah, back up just a minute. And this is where things really get interesting with respect to 1,200 pages of rules and regulations, is that it becomes discretionary. Some person then it has the discretion to decide what to do.
And that is a really fundamental problem all the way through this, and not just with penalties. You know, I actually think that they need to be penalizing, you know, frankly, companies like Peanut Corporation of America.
Well,
yes. It's slapped down a lot harder.
Yes.
But it's what do you do all along the path up to a Peanut Corporation of America? And these rules, the substance of them alone is very vague. I mean, there are a lot of things that are, you know, you have to take all reasonable steps, and you know, you have to do what is adequate to treat the food, and you have to, you know, there are these languages which it's all in the eye of the beholder. You know, farmer might be really doing their best and doing something very reasonable, and the inspector disagrees.
Or in the hands of a public official who can decide. Hey, we're going to, when we get back, Judith, I'd like to ask you just what the heck is safe food anyway? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Judith McGarry. She, the executive director of the Farm to Ranch and Ranch Freedom Alliance. Now, isn't it amazing that farms and ranches need an alliance to survive, to be free? Is this America? What's happening to us? 831-479-1080. Do join us if you so desire. We will be right back after these very important messages, so do stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie benchlands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson. We're talking with Judith McGarry. She, the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, deep in the heart of Texas today. And we're talking about the Food and Drug Administration's new 1,200 pages of rules and regulations for those who produce and distribute our food. And specifically today, we're trying to figure out who will be able to comply with those rules in order to grow our food. And so that's a real head-scratcher. Imagine yourself a small farmer and rancher, and then the mailman shows up at your door with a wheelbarrow with 1,200 pages of new rules and regulations and saying, you better comply with them. I see where the new rules are. I could fine you $1 million per transgression per day. Wow. I guess that would scare the bleep out of just about anybody, Judith.
And that's, you know, another fundamental problem that we keep running into, not just with these rules, but with a lot of what's happening with government regulation, which is just, it serves as an incredible barrier to people to either starting farming, growing their farm, mm-hmm. because, good heavens, who sets themselves up for this? So, unfortunately, you know, I've had quite a few farmers tell me that, you know, they're thrilled about the Chester-Hagen Amendment, but it means that they'll purposefully stop growing their farm before they hit the $500,000 mark,
sure.
because they don't want to put themselves into having to deal with these FDA regs.
Well, Judith, you know, I often think that 85% of all government rules and regulations are designed to restrict trade. And I'm, that, you know, and when I see that Michael Taylor from Monsanto Corporation is running this show, I just scratched my head, and I'm thinking bad thoughts.
He really is the poster child for the revolving door, and the sad thing is, although he's the poster child for it, he's so not the only one. I mean, we just
of course not.
You know, incidents after incidents of, you know, industry players going into government, the government guys getting nice cushy jobs with the industry after they leave, and you know, it defies common sense to think that this doesn't have an effect on the rules and regulations that they write and how they're enforced.
Well, let's look at these. Well, first of all, what the heck is safe food? Well, and more specifically, why did government come out with 1,200 pages of new rules and regulations?
And by the way, I do want to say something about the leg for a moment before I get to say food. Just to clarify for everyone, the actual regs are about 100 pages. But the problem is you then have about 1,100 pages of preamble that sort of explains to you what those 100 pages do. And it also references several hundred pages more of other documents that you're supposed to go look at and figure out. So it's a really fun mix of things that you're supposed to be reading.
Well, Judith, you're one of the few people I know in life who's a great policy wonk. I mean, you understand this stuff. You're an attorney. You're in the pits fighting it out with these guys. What did you read in this? What the heck is safe food?
So according to the agency, what safe food is really pretty much sterile. You know,
I'm afraid of. My great fear is that safe food is some kind of packaged soy meal manufactured with Monsanto's genetically engineered soybeans. It has no life in it, and then you add water, and you're there. And that's safe food. Is that safe food?
That's where they're heading. I mean, so first of all, you know, in the preamble, they talk about the fact that, you know, they're not even touching issues about chemical contamination or, you know, pesticides and herbicide residues, and you know that's just irrelevant. We're not worrying about that. And then you get into what they are worrying about, which is the microbiology.
Mm-hmm.
And they have, you'd think that they've gotten paid by the word. They have a term of biological soil amendments of animal origin. Really, they got paid by the word.
What does that mean, Judith?
What it means basically is anything that ever had anything to do with an animal that you want to put in soil. So bone meal, blood meal, compost, manure, all of this stuff.
All of the good stuff, right?
And they're terrified of it.
Mm-hmm.
They are stark, raving, terrified of anything that ever had to do with an animal. And so even, for instance, there's compost tea, which is where you take compost, which has been treated. It's been so you have beneficial microorganisms in it, and you add food and water and air so that you basically multiply these beneficial microorganisms. If you are foolish enough to add molasses to your compost tea, molasses, okay, not even of animal origin, this is a plant origin, then you have to treat it as if you were applying raw manure to your field if you spray that compost tea. Huh?
So, but this is starting to make sense to me, because when people use the things that people have used for millennium upon millennium upon millennium to grow food, that means that those people have control over their own food. If those people are prohibited from using those things, then they must buy other things, chemicals that can be controlled.
And this really does push people away from any sort of sustainable methods, and that's what is, you know, you can find a way through these regs. Like, you know, if you're absolutely completely dedicated, maybe you can figure out how to run, you know, a sustainable farm under these regs. But if you are, let's say, you know, one of the many people that we hope to reach out to, you know, a mid-sized conventional farmer who frankly probably is going bankrupt because the conventional system doesn't pay you worth a darn when you're selling to the commodities, and say, why don't you switch to sustainable? Why don't you start growing organic vegetables and selling directly and, you know, selling into the grocery store so that there's high-quality food even in the small groceries? You know, this would be great. And they take one look at what they have to do to use compost, which is sort of the fundamental building block of a sustainable operation. And frankly, if they're sensible, they're going to say, hey, it's not worth it. I'm sticking with the herbicides and pesticides.
So all of these rules are promulgated because there were a lot of contaminations. And I think the poster child for those contaminators is a outfit called the Peanut Corporation of America. To me, it was an absolutely filthy place that had been busted numerous times by the federal government for being an absolutely filthy place. And yet nobody ever did anything to stop them selling from absolutely filthy peanuts, which eventually contaminated the food chain, made a lot of people sick, and some died, and yet nothing happened. Here's an incident in which the federal government could have done something before all of this actually even started, and didn't.
And we saw it the same with the eggs, the salmonella outbreak from the huge egg producers in Iowa. And we see the same thing also on just the whole structure of our food system. I mean, one of the first outbreaks that triggered a lot of the headlines that built into the Food Safety Modernization Act was the spinach outbreak in California.
Right.
And that, you know, I don't think the government had any specific reasons to be suspicious of those farms ahead of time. You know, that wasn't a lack of paying attention. But the structure of our food system made it almost inevitable that something like that was going to happen. You get one batch of contaminated spinach. It goes to a huge processing plant.
Mix it in with a bunch of other spinach, and pretty soon you have a big batch of contaminated.
Exactly. And then you package it up under 34 different brand names and ship it all over the country. So no one knows where it came from. No one can make any connections between it. It's impossible to trace or understand what's happening. Well, yeah, you get problems when you have that.
But and so the entire food safety system seems to be being established to make those giant industrial-sized producers safe, and yet the rules that are put into effect for those giants are now being forced on small farmers, and thus, can they survive that? Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. We're talking about food safety. What is food safe food? Will you be able to eat it? I don't know. I think food safe food might be this pretty box of genetically engineered soy meal that has a real fancy label on it and be in a brilliant package, and it'll come to you, and it'll be on the shelf of the supermarket. And right there on the label, it will say, government safe food, just for you. We will be right back. Do stay tuned. Well, out there, what do you think safe food is? That's the question today. And how can we have safe food? And government is making an effort for us to have safe food. They just put out 1,200 pages of safe food rules and regulations and said, here, read this. And so farmers are trying to read it, but some farmers haven't been able to read it fast enough, and one of them being Judith McGeary. She, the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance, way down there deep in the heart of Texas. Have members all over the place, though, don't you, Judith?
Yes, we do. We've got members in just about every state.
And Farm and Ranch Freedom, we have to have an alliance these days, folks, so that our farmers and ranchers have the freedom to grow food for us. Because given what's going on in the world of food safety, I don't know if it's going to be like this very much longer. The regulations and rules are so onerous, it would appear that only certain kinds of farms are going to be able to grow our food. Now, somebody emailed me and suggested that what the government is doing with these new food and food safety rules and regulations, headed up by none other than Monsanto's Michael Taylor and many other industry types, is establishing a star chamber. Now, have you ever heard of a star chamber, Judith?
Yes, I've heard the term. I'm trying to sort of think that through in this context.
Well, first of all, what is a star chamber?
And you see, I've heard the term, but don't ask me for the definition of it.
Well, I had to look it up because I said, what the heck are they talking about?
I mean, so, I know vaguely the reference.
So I Googled this term, and what a star chamber refers to was a court established by an early English king. You know, they had just established the rule, the law and order. They just put out rules that people could live by and civil courts by which people could be judged and whatnot. So they just set up this whole civil way of doing things. And the king, he got kind of pissed off because, well, gee whiz, I have to go by these rules and regulations. So in his palace, in a room that had stars painted on the chamber. He set up his own court that, you know, didn't have any rules and regulations. He could try people however he wanted them to. And so, you know, first it started off as a way of, hey, avoiding all the rules and regulations and making short change of troublesome situations. And, you know, people could bring their stuff to the Star Chamber, and the king's judges would make a decision, and that would be that. But as it grew, it became a way of stealing people's property and money and giving it to their friends and whatnot. And soon it became so onerous that they were able to, like, chop people's arms off and stuff. It was really out of hand, so the legislature kind of got rid of it. But people are asking, are these new government rules and regulations kind of like setting up a Star Chamber here in the United States, in which the federal government now has the power to unilaterally go into any state at once and any community at once and confiscate food with no questions asked?
You know, as I think about it, and like I said, I'd heard the reference vaguely, and in listening to you more in depth, sort of like, here's what it was. I don't know that that's the correct comparison, and maybe it is, but it doesn't resonate with me. It's I mean, what we've got here, they are going to have to, you know, they can do a recall, they can do emergency detention orders, but then they do have to go through a process. So it's not, to me, you know, it stands out in the Star Chamber, it's the complete lack of process. You had, like, one person, they got to tell you, you know, here's what happens to you, basically, you know, or a very small group.
Mm-hmm.
This is more, I mean, for me, it's this web of regulations where the violation is in the eye of the beholder.
Well, so, wait a minute. No.
So maybe. can I just whether you compare it to the Star Chamber or not? Let me do my comparison.
Okay, go ahead.
But you've got this incredible web of regulations, and they're very public. Here they are. They're published out there. Go read them. And you may have one inspector that says you're doing just fine, and then another inspector who says you're not, and then you have to go. And there is this process, but it's an expensive process, and it's a difficult process. So you get to hire attorneys, and you have to have your attorneys go in and argue that what you'd done was consistent with the regulations. And if you can't afford attorneys, then you really are out of luck. It's just this, it's this maze. It's a confusing, badly lit maze is what I think of when I look at these.
Okay, so then it's not exactly like a Star Chamber in which the government has the absolute and total control to say this and that, and there's no absolute recourse, because there is recourse. It's just that it's so expensive, nobody can do it.
It's expensive. It's time-consuming. You might lose. I mean, if you're a farmer and you have to, you know, and whether you're a small farmer or even a large farmer or sustainable or conventional, none of them have a whole lot of extra money. I mean, no one's doing this because they're getting rich off of it at the farming level. You know, the middleman level, that's another thing. But the farming level, you're not getting rich. And, you know, if you have to spend a couple hundred thousand on attorney's fees, in practical terms, You either just go along with whatever, you figure out how to comply with what your inspector told you, or you go out of business.
Which then, in effect, is kind of like a Star Chamber then.
There is that.
The potential
consequences are really devastating.
So let me ask you this, Judith McGeary, you the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. Can these government rules and regulations be used to control the competition for the marketplace?
What they do, I think, is they keep pushing us very strongly along the world of the biggest operations win. Mm-hmm. You know, and that, you, on one hand, you can call that control. I just use a slightly different term, but it creates this incredible advantage for the very largest of operations.
Let's see if we can work that through. Why would it be an advantage for a very large farm to have these rules as opposed to a small farm? Well, I mean, they're equal rules, are they not? So so let's talk about why it would be an advantage for a very big farm and a disadvantage for a very small farm to have to comply with the same rules that were essentially designed to prevent industrial-sized farms from contaminated food chain. I mean, these rules
were
not
justified. No. They were justified on that basis. They weren't designed on that basis. Those are two very different things.
Okay, so that's going to be the question we're going to have to come to grips with when we come back from this break. Why is it an advantage for a very large farm to have these 1,200 pages of rules and regulations, where it's a disadvantage for a small farm? After all, they're both growing our food, so shouldn't they both have to comply with the same rules? Where will all of those rules then take our food chain? Who will be able to grow our food? That's up next with Judith McGeary. She's the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. Now, folks, if you want our farms and ranches to have the freedom to produce our food, you should tune in with the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance and maybe give them a leg up. We will be right back. Hey, welcome back. Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. We have a big question on the table right now for Judith McGeary. She's the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. That question being, why is it different? Why is it an advantage for a very large farm to have all of these rules and regulations and a disadvantage for a very small farm? Judith?
And to start, by the way, I think even the large farms, there are pieces of this that are going to cause problems for them. And I know even the large farmers are concerned about these regulations, which should tell you something. But it's still going to be easier for them and therefore an advantage for them compared to the smaller farms.
Why is it easier?
Particularly, there are several reasons. One is just literally size. The larger you get, the larger your gross is, the more likely you are to have included, by the way, you know, administrative staff, people, you know, workers you can assign to do some of this work, as opposed to the smaller farmers that don't have that workforce and are already trying to, frankly, work too many hours just to keep the farm running.
Let's say these new rules cost $1,000 per month to comply with, and one farmer has 1,000 acres and another farmer has 1 acre, so it's going to cost each farmer $1,000 a month. But if you have 1,000 acres, that's only $1 an acre. But if you have 1 acre, that's $1,000.
Exactly. And that, you stole where I was going next. I
mean, I'm sorry.
Like, but you do it better than I do it, Michael.
I don't think so.
But that, for instance, you know, using a specific example, you know, the water testing I mentioned, where you have to test your water source every week. Again, you're right. You know, if the cost of that's being spread out over 1 acre, that's very different than if the cost of your weekly water test is being spread out over 100 or 1,000 acres. And then there's also the question of diversity, because there are actually quite a few things that are exempt from this rule. All of the really sort of commodity crops, the grain crops, are for the most part exempt. If you're sending food for processing, so let's say you're growing 1,000 acres of green beans to sell to a canning company, you're exempt from almost all, if not all, of this rule. If you're growing, you know, just one crop, it's often easier to figure out what you have to do versus if you're growing 20 different crops.
And if you're a small farmer growing for, like, the farmer's market, you're growing 20 crops.
Exactly. It's going to be much more confusing. First of all, you may grow some crops that are exempt from the regs. You may grow a lot of crops that aren't exempt from the regs. How do you handle when they're intermingled?
So these rules and regulations were established for and by the industrial systems, and then they're being applied equally to non-industrial systems. And they're saying, essentially, take these rules and there you go.
Hey, exactly.
Let's go to the phones. We're at 831-479-1080, and we're going to go talk right now with Harry, who is in Black Mountain, North Carolina. I've never been to Black Mountain, North Carolina, Harry, but it sounds like fun.
Thank you. It is. We're near Asheville in the mountains of western North Carolina, so a lot of people have been to our area.
Wow. Sounds beautiful. I'm going.
We'll look forward to seeing you.
Okay, come. Good.
What I'm concerned about is that a lot of the farms around here are very, very small in
sure.
general. And a lot of those small farmers see the $500,000 figure, and they say, well, I'm not going to get there, so I don't have to worry about this. And so my question to Judith is, can you really fly beneath the radar, or are we looking at problems down the road where you're later going to run into problems getting insurance because you're not in compliance with the rules? Yeah. We've already had one case of that come up around here on dried herbs.
You know, Harry, this is kind of like the old thing about the camel's nose under the tent, right?
Right.
Only this is like a Tyrannosaurus Rex.
He's got a couple of noses, I think. Yeah, no, I mean, there are a lot of different ways this can cause problems, even for the smaller farmers over time. The insurance one is a good example. Another example is if you do want to sell at least some of it retail. So, you know, let's say you're a small farmer, most of what you're selling goes to a CSA or a farmer's market. But you want to sell, you know, you grow really nice tomatoes and you want to get into Whole Foods or you want to get into Kroger's. Nothing stops those retailers from saying, you know what, I don't really care if FDA says you have to or not. I expect, you know, if you want to sell to us, you have to comply with the federal rules, and they'll do it to protect themselves. I mean, they'll do it as sort of, you know, covering their own situation. And so, yeah, there are still implications, you know, even with the Tester-Hagen Amendment. It not only caps people from growing over a certain size, but, yeah, there are still implications even below that.
So this is not only working on farmers, but it's also it's not only forcing farmers to go one direction, it seems to be forcing consumers to eat in one direction.
Well, that's a necessary outgrowth. You know, that's why, you know, FARFA, we have both farmers and consumers as our members, and what we talk about a lot is, you know, the consumers need to be involved. Because if you want to have the choice as to what you eat, the choice as to who you buy from, you know, the choice as to what types of foods or how it was grown, then you've got to step up and protect the farmers who are trying to grow the food the way you want it and how you want it and where you want it. Because otherwise, you know, no farmers, no food is a pretty simple, you know, lesson in life.
Mm-hmm. And it goes right to Michael Olson's first law of the food chain, which is, agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles. And no food and no sandcastles. It seems to be that's where we're headed. Harry, what do you think we should do?
Well, I want to take it one step further before I answer that question. That is, my wife, Elaine, and I own a store for local healthy food here in Black Mountain. It's called the Black Mountain Farmers Market. And we have to, you know, we have insurance, right? And that insurance company is at some point or other going to be hearing information about these rules and the impact of these, and they're going to see cases.
Harry, can you hold that for just a second? We have to take a quick break, and we'll pick it up right on the other side. Can you hold?
Sure.
All right, we will be right back with Harry in Black Mountain, North Carolina, and Judith McGeary deep in the heart of Texas. And you, right back. There we are. We are back. And this is the Food Chain. We have a lot to talk about and so little time to talk about it. With, Judith McGeary, she the executive director of the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance. Judith, how do we get in touch with the Farm and Ranch Freedom Alliance?
So our website is farmandranchfreedom.org. People can also call 254-697-2661. Or visit our Facebook page, which is just facebook.com/farmandranchfreedom.
Good. Send money. Help us out.
That's always helpful.
There you go. Harry in Black Mountain, North Carolina, go along. You're talking about your little store, your health food store, and in the insurance company.
Right. And so what we're looking at is right now we can buy from anyone, you know, and we buy is from all of the local producers that we can. You know, we have a chance to look at them, and we decide whether or not we want their product to be sold at our store. But that's tens of thousands of dollars a year of product that we can buy. But if our insurance company comes to us and says, wait a second, we need you to have checked out to make certain that all of these farmers are in compliance with these new rules, or we won't sell you insurance, then my hands become tied because I have to have insurance.
So, Harry, pretty soon the only health food you're going to be able to buy is something in a brilliantly colored package that contains genetically engineered soybean meal. It says organic healthy food or something on it.
Exactly. The local food movement is going to be crushed. And here in my valley, we've got a school called Warren Wilson, and it's putting out young people that want to farm.
Mm-hmm.
And these laws are going, and regulations are going to have a terrible effect on them, because how are they going to get started when they have all this information that they don't know and have all these things that they have to comply with?
Harry, do you think that that is the aim of the Food Safety Modernization Act of 2010?
No, I don't. I think that it's a group of people that were supporting a particular style of regulation, and they believe truly that they are going to make a big difference. You know, you had a public service ad that came in the middle of this that said, from the FDA, by the way,
mm-hmm.
that 1 in 6 people get sick every year from food safety problems.
Right. And what are they from eating your food in your store, Harry?
No. And see, it's just simply not true, okay, that what you have there is a grotesque estimate that was put out by the CDC as an estimate, but it now gets people get told that it's true. If you look at the actual statistics that are published by the CDC, the numbers are essentially stable.
Well, Harry, in Black Mountain, North Carolina, let me ask you this. Will local food survive the federal government's effort to make food safe?
Oh, yeah, it will. It's just it'll only be available to those who are very rich.
Judith McGeary, what do you think?
What Harry just outlined is one possibility. The bigger problem, though, almost is it's not clear if local foods does survive, because we're an interactive network. We depend on each other. The livestock farmers depend on the vegetable farmers, and we depend on small retailers like Harry. And, you know, it's this whole web. And we're already, in some ways, a very, very small web. And there are only so many hits we can take. I think there's hope yet, because these aren't final. But point is, what we're asking FDA right now is give us more time. Let us get people involved. Let us get people aware of what's going on.
And there we go. Out of time. Judith McGeary, thank you very much. Harry in Black Mountain, North Carolina, thank you for calling in. And thank you all for tuning in. Hey, remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.